firefighters are all, I think, realize that we've you know, avoided a disaster here.
Firefighters make more progress on the Funny River Fire. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, May 28th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, state ferry workers vote to authorize a strike.
If we get to July 1st and we don't have a contract, we could strike at that point.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Light rain and diminished wind has helped keep the Funny River Fire from substantial growth over the past 2 days. It's 30% contained, and as of this afternoon, it's estimated to have burned more than 183,000 acres on the central Kenai Peninsula. KBBI's Shady Grove Oliver has this update.
A crew of more than 700 people has been fighting the fire around the clock. High winds and dry conditions fueled its spread last week. But over the past few days, the weather has been on the firefighters' side. And now fire management officials are able to give some good news.
All evacuation advisories were lifted late this morning for the area around the Funny River Fire. And that's good news for the homeowners. You don't have to stay on hair trigger alert that things are going to change for the worse. Things are looking much, much better with the rain. And the rain forecast is, or the weather forecast is looking for even more rain and finally maybe some harder rain later this week.
That's Jim Schwarber, a public information officer with the Alaska Incident Management Team.
This weather really moderates fire behavior and allows the firefighters to get in closer and do direct line building and do a direct attack on the fire instead of defending. The neighborhoods were able to go after the fire and further contain it.
But Schwarber says the amount of rain falling is not enough to penetrate the thick canopy of black spruce. That means for a while, there will still be hot spots where the fire is smoldering. And if the rain stops, the ground will dry out quickly. He says that could lead to more active fires down the line. But he says the team in place has a lot of support.
I think something that is really important to note is this fire is now ranked number one in priority in the nation. And that's something Alaska fires rarely do.
That's because it's not competing for resources with many other large fires in the lower 48. At this time, Schwarber says operations are still focused on containing the part of the fire that jumped the Kenai River. But he says crews have nearly completed a containment line along the entire western and northern flanks. Schwarber says the fire has been growing to the southeast on the shore of Tustamina Lake. There are several cabins in that area, as well as a fish weir. Firefighting crews have been sent in to prepare those structures. Hotshot crews are in place to defend them if the fire does spread in that direction. Overall, Schwarber says the team has made good progress and is planning for the next few days.
This has been a big, significant fire. A lot was at risk here from this fire and the community, and firefighters are all, I think, realize that we've avoided a disaster here.
Weather can be a wild card, but crews are hoping for more rain so they can continue to keep one step ahead of the Funny River Fire. Reporting from Soldotna, I'm Shady Grove Oliver.
Yesterday marked 1 week since the Funny River Fire began burning on the Kenai Peninsula. Very early on, one group from Fairbanks has been in control of the firefighting efforts. KBBI's Aaron Selvig has more on the Alaska Interagency Incident Management Team.
In a stressful, constantly changing situation like the Funny River Fire, who steps in to take control?
It's like walking into a buzzsaw.
That's Bernie Panetta, Fire Information Officer for the Alaska Interagency Incident Management Team. The team, based out of Fort Wainwright near Fairbanks, has been on the scene in Soldotna for nearly a week. The team of about 40 people quickly set up a command center at Skyview High School, and from there started coordinating all firefighting efforts. It helps that the team is tied in with the National Incident Command Center in Boise, Idaho.
So when the bell rings and the alarm goes off, a call is made for a request for a team specifically in this case. And then we get mobilized and away we go.
Panetta says that as of Wednesday morning, there have been many successes fighting different fronts of the fire, but there is still much to do. On the northwestern part of the fire, nearest the Sterling Highway, firefighters are using hand tools like shovels and Pulaskis to dig a hand line. That's a shallow trench down to the bare soil that will stop or at least slow the fire's advance. Further east, near the Funny River neighborhood that was evacuated over the weekend, crews are using heavy equipment, including bulldozers and Caterpillar excavators, to dig wider containment lines. Panetta said those two lines linked up Tuesday afternoon. Of course, the rain that has finally been falling on the Kenai Peninsula over the last day or two has been a welcome sight for firefighters.
The only problem is we're going to need about 5 or 6 more days of constant precip in order for it to be significant. With all the canopy that's out there, and it's in some places it's pretty decadent in terms of some of the black spruce and such, it doesn't really permeate down to the carpeted floor.
It's that forest floor, says Panetta, filled with dead grasses and spruce needles, that's one of the reasons the fire grew so quickly. Another is wind.
This is the second day that we've enjoyed the weather as far as in terms of there's no real issues with wind, which was driving and testing our lines. The strongest that we were seeing out there was 20 to 25 with 30 mile an hour gusts as well.
When a big fire like this happens, especially one so close to populated communities, information can spread with the wind too. Panetta says the team has used traditional tools to get the latest fire updates out to the public, including roadside signs and community meetings. But what's the best way to reach the most people?
Nowadays, in this case, social media is really almost like a tool. Well, it is a tool. The team does have their own Facebook page that the amount of hits that we've had on that has been incredible.
Reporting from Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Officials overseeing the Tyonek wildfire on the west side of Cook Inlet said today most firefighting personnel were being released from the fire, with some of them headed to the Kenai Peninsula to work on the Funny River fire. The Tyonek fire started May 19th and burned between the villages of Tyonek and Beluga. It is currently mapped at 1,906 acres and is considered 100% contained. A total of 112 personnel were still assigned to Tyonek this morning, but most were scheduled to leave by the end of the day. Governor Sean Parnell signed the state operating and capital budgets this afternoon in downtown Anchorage, beginning with a speech to the Rotary Club, in which he said the legislature met the spending targets he laid out for it.
The legislature met the spending limit, and there are no vetoes this year. So...
Parnell noted that the legislature has cut general fund spending by $1 billion each year for the last 3 years, and by dipping into reserves, it has reduced future payments into the projected $12 billion deficit in retirement funds for teachers and state employees.
Our administration, we with the legislature, made sustainable the single biggest cost driver in the budget. I proposed paying down a portion of that debt, that $12 billion debt, and then lowering our annual payments. Legislators approved that concept, and they unanimously agreed, Republicans and Democrats, unanimously agreed to move $3 billion from the Constitutional Budget Reserve into the retirement trust funds.
The governor says that one-time payment will reduce future payments that were expected to rise to more than $1 billion a year to $300 million. The budget includes an education funding formula increase that will continue in future years. The total of all budgets, including federal funds, is $12.8 billion. Oil companies and Alaska municipalities have 30 days to decide whether to appeal a State Assessment Review Board decision to set the value of the Trans-Alaska Pipeline at $10.2 billion. The Fairbanks Daily News Miner reports the state assessor had put the value at $5.7 billion, a difference of nearly $4.5 billion. oil companies say the pipeline should be assessed at just 2.7. Municipalities argued for an assessment of nearly $13.8 billion. The board chose a figure closest to the municipality's request. The decision drew strong interest after Governor Sean Parnell dismissed the board's former chairman, former Anchorage property assessor Marty McGee, and replaced him with a member with a lengthy career with the oil industry. Oil companies have appealed the board's assessment for 8 years. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, searchers have spent 4 days looking for a missing hiker in Juneau.
We don't have a lot of clues. Right now we're doing area-based searches.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska Mental Health Trust beneficiaries are important members of our workforce, from healthcare facilities and nonprofit organizations to retail stores and restaurants. Alaskans who are in recovery or experience developmental disabilities, traumatic brain injuries, or mental health conditions are succeeding in the workplace. The Trust encourages businesses to consider ways in which employing trust beneficiaries can be good for business. Learn more at mhtrust.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Mental Health Trust.
A second generation of Malots is taking over the helm at Sea Alaska. The Regional Native Corporation's board of directors named Anthony Malott as president and CEO during a shareholder meeting last night in Anchorage. He's the son of former CEO and longtime board member Byron Malott, who's running for governor as a Democrat. The younger Malott says he has a good relationship with his father, but they limit their conversations.
We do not discuss business. You know, we've kept that outside our relationship. Of course, he's offered fatherly advice my whole entire life.
Anthony Malott has been Sea Alaska's treasurer and chief investment officer for the past 8 years. The 39-year-old says that and his previous experience got him the job.
I've spent 18 years in the investment management field. I have a very experienced background in that regard. And I really think the board saw that as one of the very important attributes that we need in the CEO as we move into this phase of acquiring new investments and operating entities.
Sea Alaska is in the midst of changing some of its financial policies with a goal of providing more jobs and higher dividends to shareholders. To do that, it must recover from last year's substantial shortfall. Sea Alaska reported about $57 million of operating losses during 2013. Revenues from investments and other sources brought that down to around $35 million. Malott says the corporation is still financially strong.
We have assets that, at a minimum, will provide a strong level of income in this coming year. So the turnaround's already happening.
He'll take over the reins from current CEO Chris McNeil Jr. on June 28th, the day of Sea Alaska's annual meeting. A bill that would give tribes greater jurisdiction over substance abuse, domestic violence, and other misdemeanors was passed out of the U.S. Senate Indian Affairs Committee last week, despite objections from the state. KNBA's Jacqueline Estes reports.
The sponsor of the Safe Families and Villages bill, U.S. Senator Mark Begich, says it encourages tribes to work with the state of Alaska to develop agreements on tribal court jurisdiction. But he says it also gives tribes a way to take on added responsibilities through an agreement with the federal government. Begich says that takes away the state's veto authority over tribal jurisdiction that was in an earlier version of the bill.
What I tried to do is make sure that the law was stronger in the sense of the relationship it would have with the Department of Justice versus the state of Alaska, because the state of Alaska, as you know, does not recognize tribes, and they wanted total control over making the decision, and we felt that was not appropriate.
Native American Rights Fund staff attorney Natalie Landreth says another important part of the bill is it amends the Violence Against Women Act to delete Section 910, which had been inserted by Alaska Senator Lisa Murkowski.
It had this ridiculous way that it was formed, where it said, we're going to add a savings clause, meaning you can do everything you were doing before, but then it said, except Alaska. And that except Alaska muddied the waters so heavily that someone like me who litigates could not have explained to a court in a coherent way, Your Honor, there's a savings clause and an exemption. Here's what it means.
Landreth says tribes need the added authority because the state provides inadequate law enforcement in dozens of villages.
Previous to the VAWA reauthorization in 2012, tribes have been exercising a lot of civil authority over domestic violence in their villages because people forget they're often the only entity there, the only government entity for hundreds, sometimes thousands of miles. So they will issue domestic violence protection orders. They will tell someone to stay away from somebody else. They will banish people, blue ticket them, you know, tell them to leave until the situation has died down or until the tribe determines that existed. And it's not uncommon. You may not hear about it that often, but it exists.
Attorney General Michael Garrity says the goal of the Safe Families and Villages bill is laudable.
I certainly agree with the goal, which is to try to reduce the crime and improve public safety in these communities, and the state's working on that in conjunction with tribes. We have been for several months now, but so I agree with the goal, but I disagree with the means by which this bill tries to accomplish that.
Garrity says the state of Alaska has been working with Tanana Chiefs Conference for the past couple of months to create an agreement that would accomplish the same goal, with one caveat.
It does empower tribes to deal with offenses, certain offenses, enumerated offenses that occur within their communities, if the offender has agreed to be diverted to tribal court.
Murkowski had supported an earlier version of the bill, but didn't sign on as co-sponsor of this version. The Safe Families and Villages Act now awaits scheduling on the Senate floor. Reporting in Anchorage, I'm Jocelyn Estes.
Alaska Marine Highway workers approved a strike authorization this week, meaning the Inland Boatmen's Union could call for workers to strike within the next month if the union and state can't agree on a new contract. For member station KHNS, Margaret Friedenauer has more.
More than 500 ferry workers statewide are represented by the union. Their current contract ends June 30th. According to Kerry Crocker, chairman for the Alaska region of the IBU, 417 members voted in the recent election, and only 8 opposed a strike authorization. That does not yet mean a strike is imminent, as Crocker explains.
If we get to July 1st and we don't have a contract and we're not able to come to agreement, we could strike at that point. It gives us the authorization to call a strike.
But an authorization vote does mean a strike could happen quickly if IBU National President Alan Cote decides to call a strike to try to force the state's position.
He would have to authorize that, but because we have the pre-authorization from the members, that the decision could be made that quickly.
The state and union are at an impasse over workers' cost of living adjustments, or COLA. Currently, ferry workers get between a 15 to 20% cost of living adjustment. That's the highest COLA of any sector of state worker, according to the Department of Administration. The state is proposing reducing the adjustment to 5% for ferry workers hired after July 1st. There was an attempt to codify a reduction in the COLA through a state Senate bill this legislative session, but it stalled in committee. Curtis Thayer is the commissioner of the Department of Administration. He said in April the state's proposed reduction would bring ferry workers' COLA more in line with other state employees and likely keep the Marine Highway from having to cut services.
From the state's perspective, we need to look at cost savings, and we've identified the cost of living differential where we can keep all the employees whole that are employed today, but in the future changing that, which provides a cost saving to the state of $600,000 to $800,000 a year, and that is enough money to prevent us tying up a boat or reducing service.
Crocker says the union would concede to no pay raises for 2 years, but it wants to preserve the current cost of living adjustments for future workers. While the IBU Alaska ferry workers have never striked before, they did have strike authorization votes during contract negotiations in the early 90s. A State Department of Transportation spokesperson said there is no contingency to continue operating the ferries if workers strike. The department would just make sure the ferries are secured and safe in ports. The state and union plan to meet again June 10th for another round of negotiations. Reporting in Haines, I'm Marga Friedenauer.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Salmon aren't just another fish in Alaska. They're our lifeblood, a source of food, rich tradition, jobs, businesses, and community. They're as resilient as Alaskans themselves and as creative and resourceful, too. At salmonlove.com, you'll find a site dedicated to Alaskans' connection with our state's most famed fish. Enjoy stories, tips, fun, and lots of other salmon-y goodness, too. Salmonlove.com. This message brought to you by the Salmon Project.
Hooligan's Lodging became one of Soldotna's main hubs during the evacuation of the Funny River fire. Though most evacuees have returned home, the hotel is ready in case the fire moves toward the community again. KSKA's Ann Hillman stopped by.
The lobby of Hooligan's Lodging and Saloons looks more like a garage sale than a hotel.
I have like toothpaste and toothbrushes and shampoo and conditioner and lotion and soap.
Hooligan's owner, Molly Poland, walks through the piles of things donated by community members. They're for the people who were evacuated because of the Funny River fire.
Area here, so we have cat litter because there were lots of cats and they didn't remember the litter boxes, so I kind of was like, okay, let's get that handled. So we got cat litter, litter boxes, dog food.
130 people and 30 animals stayed at the Long Wooden Hotel over the weekend for free. She says she turned away paying customers because she just wanted to help.
I didn't expect for people to be so grateful. I was just trying to help. Sorry, I'm getting a clip.
Oh, no.
I've had so many people, one lady yesterday looked at me and she goes, you're going straight to heaven. It made me tear up too. And then this morning when I went to my car and it was raining, I started crying. I'm like, why am I crying over rain? But I was just so happy because I know all these people are displaced and they want their homes, you know.
Other businesses and community members chipped in as well. People opened up their homes, offered free childcare, boarded dogs and kennels for free, gave away free pet food. The list goes on. Odie's Deli was one of the restaurants that offered discounted and free food to evacuees and firefighters. Owner Melody Symington said she just wanted to give back.
I am truly amazed by the outpouring of this community. It's just amazing how they've all pulled together and people just giving their own money and their own resources.
Back at Hooligan's, evacuees have gone home, but the work continues. April Folk scrubs the floors of one of the hotel rooms to rid the place of dog smells.
My mom always had me on the floor cleaning with my hands, so that's what I've done.
She says she's volunteering to clean because Soldotna is her home. She says the fire has brought people together in a way she's never seen.
Wow. An amazing amount of support, encouragement, wisdom was shared. Everybody just came together. It was just amazing, actually.
Folk says the community is trying to share another message as well.
Thanks to all the firefighters, the crew in the air, just thank you. I mean, it seems like that's not enough to say, but I guess as long as we keep pulling together, we can show them our gratitude.
Hooligan's owner, Poland, says she knows they aren't out of danger yet. She says they're holding on to the items people have donated until the fire is far away from the community. In Soldotna, I'm Ann Hillman.
Volunteers spent a fourth day today searching for missing hiker, 48-year-old Sharon Bice. Yesterday's efforts resulted in no new leads. Bice was reported missing Saturday evening after she didn't show up for a planned group hike with the Juneau Alpine Club. KTOO's Lisa Fu was at the command center at the top of Mount Roberts Tram yesterday.
Alaska State Troopers say Southeast Alaska Dogs Organized for Ground Search, or Sea Dogs, have detected the scent of Sharon Bice on the Mount Roberts Trail where teams have been searching. Her scent was first detected on the trail above Mount Roberts Tram Sunday. Tuesday morning, a different search and rescue dog detected her scent closer to the Mount Roberts trailhead near the parking lot on Basin Road. Bice's black Honda Civic was located there Saturday morning by a friend. Trooper Sergeant Timothy Burt says these are good leads and confirms the search team is on the right track, but a lot more information is still needed.
We don't have a lot of clues. Right now we're doing area-based searches, the trail corridor, and other routes along the ridgelines and hills here. We haven't found any clues to go off of to base our searches on.
Bice was first reported missing 10:30 Saturday evening, and the search effort started a few hours later around 1 a.m. Sunday morning. The search has been confined to where Bice might go for a day hike. Bert says there's no indication that she went on anything longer since her overnight backpack was found in her house and she had a hike scheduled the following morning to Hawthorne Peak. Troopers haven't found Bice's cell phone. Bert says the cell phone company hasn't been able to identify the phone's location, indicating it could be turned off. The Coast Guard conducted a helicopter search Sunday evening with night vision and thermal imaging devices, but didn't come up with any leads. The Search and Rescue Command Center is located in the Mount Roberts Tram Restaurant. James Dooley is with Juneau Mountain Rescue.
And we're up here because it gives us a better line of sight for our radios with our search teams out in the field, as well as just kind of puts us closer to the incident. It's also a convenient jumping off point for our search teams because our search is kind of centered in this area right now.
Two teams were deployed by helicopter to Mount Juneau and the Gastineau Peak area early Tuesday morning, while the rest of the roughly 20 searchers hiked up from the tram or from the Mount Roberts trailhead. Dooley says ground searchers work in teams of two or three.
In search and rescue, you don't necessarily look for the person. I mean, that'd be great, but you look for clues, looking for anything and everything that might be related or not related, but just want to document it, you know, shoe tracks, wrappers, pieces of her property or things that can be tied back to her, just anything that might give us some clue or some bit of information.
Bice was last seen Friday morning between 9:30 and 10 a.m. at Alaska Marine Lines.
The last person we know that saw her on Friday said that she was wearing bright colored like exercise clothing, and it seems fairly consistent as to what her friends say she usually hikes in. And she currently has a black cast on her left hand and is described as very active, very fit.
Bice has lived in Juneau for about 10 years. She's a physical therapist with Juneau Physical Therapy out of its Valley location inside the Alaska Club. Sergeant Burt reminds hikers to carry a form of communication and wear bright clothing. In Juneau, I'm Lisa Fu.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Shady Grove Oliver and Ann Hillman in Soldotna, Aaron Selbig in Homer, Jacqueline Estes in Anchorage, Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Margaret Friedenauer in Haines, and Lisa Fu in Juneau. APRN Steve Heimel reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. May is National Bike Safety Month. Alaskans are riding their bikes to school, work, and play. Motorists, be on the lookout for bikes and pedestrians. Bicyclists, follow the rules of the road. All riders should wear a fitted helmet and use reflectors and safety lights to be seen no matter what time of day. Go to injuryprevention.alaska.gov for safety tips. This message sponsored by the Alaska Highway Safety Office and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.